This is Fresh Air. Crack cocaine has changed the drug market and urban life. Crack is comparatively cheap, and it's enabled drug dealers to sell to the very poor. And in these times of unemployment, the drug market has become one of the main employers of inner-city teenagers. My guest, Terry Williams, is a sociologist who's been studying the culture that's developed around the sale and use of crack. He spent 4 years observing the members of one crack house in New York City. This wasn't a place to buy. It was a place where several people lived and others came to use. Williams is the author of the new book Crack House and an earlier book called The Cocaine Kids. He teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York. I asked him what it was like to be at the crack house while people were doing crack.
Well, first of all, there are clouds of smoke that sort of crawl all along the edges of the floor and in the corners, and it seems to creep everywhere. And I had this sense most of the time of being enveloped in this kind of cloud, which the crack users referred to as the blizzard when it was encased in the bottom of the glass pipe, in the belly of the pipe. Most of the folk would reach a kind of repose after taking what they call a hit or blast on the pipe. They would close their eyes and freeze for a moment. And others would be more animated. They would move about, trying to find a favorite spot, which all crack users like to find. Other people would elevate themselves, stand on a chair or a table. And this elevation increased the power of the high, or so I was told. And so my sitting, observing, oftentimes without listening to what people were saying, just watching behavior and gestures, was what I did most of the time.
You must have felt pretty odd sitting there watching everybody get high.
Well, I felt odd when people didn't engage me. But for the most part, I was also engaged. I would find a person who looked willing to talk, or was willing to talk, or man or woman or boy or girl, who would sit next to me and articulate what beaming up meant, or some other element of the culture meant, or they would describe their feelings about the house or a person in the house, or tell me about their lives, where they had come from, and how they had arrived at the crack house.
So you'd interview people while they were high, huh?
I'd interview people while they were high because this was a state of intoxication, most preferred and most often caught in. People were caught in this intoxication most of the time because part of the what they call the A side of the high, that is the euphoric side, is where people want to reach most of the time. And since it lasts for a short time, and then the B side takes over, i.e. the dysphoria side, people are engaging in whatever they're doing while they're intoxicated most of the time. And so it's not unusual to be talking to people while they're high because they're constantly either picking up the pipe, cleaning the pipe, smoking on the pipe, or high from the pipe.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you say, sex is the currency in the crack house. So people give sex for drugs?
Yes. Most of the time, what you have is a community, a drug community, that is dominated by males. And most of the dealers are men. 99% of the dealers are men. There are very few women who are dealers. And so the men control the drug. And because the drug stimulates the central nervous system, and it also creates general arousal in the brain, which is interpreted as sexual arousal, and it in fact becomes sexual arousal for the most part. People want to engage in sexual activity when they are high on the drug. And so women, when they don't have any money and they can't afford, they can't borrow any more money, what they do is they use sex as currency.
So did you get a sense of whether women resented having to sell their bodies for crack? I mean, what their consciousness was about selling their bodies for crack?
Well, I was sort of getting to your point about asking them. Yes, I did. I talked to quite a few women. In the culture, it's called buffing. I mean, that's the word that's used when women provide oral sex for the drug. And there's a category of women in the crack house called buffers, and they're noted for their ability to perform oral sex, and so they are highly sought after by dealers and by others, by men who find out that these women are good at doing this, and other women, by the way, because there's a great deal of gay sex in the crack culture too. Although I didn't document as much of it as I did heterosexual sex.
You mentioned oral sex, and from your book, I get the impression that it really is predominantly oral sex that's given in exchange for crack.
Well, it is, and that's because it's portable. The crack houses are usually populated with a lot of people. There's a lot of coming and going on. There are very, very few places of privacy, and so the idea of flatback sex or missionary sex is more difficult to perform. Not impossible, and people, of course, do go out. They go to rooftops. They go to other places to have flatback sex. But oral sex is by far the most preferred and the most predominant. But asking women why they perform sex has gotten to somewhat touchy issues. Not because they weren't willing to articulate what it's about, but they did not want to be viewed as prostitutes. They did not want to see themselves as whores, if you will, which is understandable, partly because the role of the whore in the community, if you're tagged as a whore in the community, you all of your opportunities for marriage or anything else gets really your chances become minimized, as it were. But when I asked women why they performed, most of them would say that they performed because they were high and because they wanted more of the drug. They wanted to perform because they knew that this was the way to get to the drug.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Terry Williams, author of the new book Crack House, Notes from the End of the Line. We'll take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Terry Williams, author of the book Crack House. He's also the author of the book The Cocaine Kids. And he studied one crack house off and on for a period of about 4 years and visited many others over that period of time. Were the people who you were studying always asking you for money?
Yes. At first that didn't happen, but when the thirst when that would come down, people would say, "Do you have a dollar?" or "I'm hungry. Could you give me some money for food?" And occasionally I would do that. And of course, sometimes they would buy food, but oftentimes they would go out and buy drugs. And then it got to the point where I refused to do that because I would make it clear to them that I don't have any money, number one, and number two, I can't give them money to buy drugs. And then it became a non-issue. I was simply there as a reporter of a sort, as a person, as an ethnographer there to record their lives. And that was the role that I undertook.
There were some health problems among the group mm-hmm. that you studied. And I guess the story I found most disturbing, there was a pregnant woman who mm-hmm. was addicted to crack, and her water broke. And instead of going right to the hospital, she stayed a few hours to smoke some more.
Yeah. Sufrida. That was Sufrida.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's an example of how everything is dropped for the drug.
Yeah, it is. And she recovered for a time. And then she ended up being busted in a freak situation, a TNT bust in a block, and she would happen to be walking there, and they picked her up. But yeah, that scene was a very sad situation. But it's interesting that in the crack house, there were women who came in who did get pregnant, but there was a lot of concern about pregnant women, and they refused to give the drug to them, which created many, many problems, of course. Anger, bickering, arguing about that. But there was a concern about it. And also there were many dealers who would not sell cocaine to visibly pregnant women. But Sufrida was so overwhelmed with her own pain and so overwhelmed with her need to self-medicate that when her water did break, she continued to get high. And that baby, I think, ended up being okay. But she had another baby who was really a crack baby, and he was born with a horrible cough. And so it really seared his lungs because she was smoking some alcohol, using alcohol to light the pipe because she didn't have a butane torch. And it created really a lot of damage to the lungs of the child.
What kind of emotions did it bring out in you to being hanging around people who had just lost everything except their ability to get high? Did it make you angry, or was it more of a feeling of heartbreak? Do you know what I mean? What were the range of personal emotions you felt watching this happen?
Well, I didn't get angry so much as I did having a great deal of despair, feeling a great deal of despair. Because I did talk to people about getting jobs or to doing other kinds of things to get out of it. And I realized the drug was much more powerful than any kind of preaching that one could do. And I tried to avoid doing too much of that anyway. There were folk who came to me and said, "Look, I want to stop. I want to get out." Because I knew, basically, it came down to that. They had to first want to get out. They knew it was one day at a time getting out. And they knew that one hit was too much and 1,000 was not enough. But many of them still, they continued because they had such personal misery, I think, that this high was something that they needed. They needed to self-medicate because in order to deal with the world. And so I was more saddened, I think, than anything else over the course of this research.
The crack house that you studied closed in April of 91. Why did it close?
Well, it closed because Headache, who was head of it, left to go to a rehabilitation center out of the country. And because his family actually came to get him, and they had asked me if I would help find him and get him out of that place because they felt that he was going to completely destroy himself if he stayed any longer. When he left, the lease, the ability to maintain the lease was in jeopardy and or pay the rent, of course. And since nobody else could take over, they all had to leave, and it closed.
When his family approached you and asked you to find him, were you willing to comply with the request?
Well, his family had made that request several times, and other friends of his had come to me over the years to get him out. And I had approached him, and I talked to him, and he didn't want to do that at the time. He wanted to live his life the way he wanted to, and this included being in this crack culture and being in this community, and so he didn't want to leave. The idea of him leaving bothered him a great deal because one of the first opportunities came when a friend of his offered him a $75,000 job through me. He said, "Would I please pass this on to him if he would just leave that house, leave that crack? We'll give him $75,000 as a salesperson." And he told me one day, he said, "You know, I don't want to be another Willie Loman. I don't want to be in a hotel in a city that I don't know what it is, and away from everybody that I care about, which happened to be the people in the crack house." And so he refused to leave.
Some people doing a study would feel that they're getting too involved by trying to talk somebody out of the drugs they were taking, trying to talk them into changing their life. You didn't have a problem with that?
I have no problem with that at all. And I have always taken a more activist role in doing this research. I think as sociologists or anthropologists, we are too much tied to this notion that you have to be totally objective and that you have to somehow stand away and not get involved. I got involved, and I will continue to get involved because I think as people are dying in this particular world, we have to do something about it, and I'm not immune from that. I'm not immune from people's pain, and I want to help where I can, and that's what I've done.
Well, Terry Williams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Terry Williams is the author of Crack House. This is Fresh Air.